In 1990, a doctor in the metropolitan Detroit area came to national prominence after publicly assisting in the suicide of a 55-year-old woman who had been diagnosed with Alzheimer's disease. Dr. Jack Kevorkian started advertising for, quote, death counseling about 3 years earlier in the Detroit newspapers. The state of Michigan had then charged him with murder, but the charges were dropped because at that time, there were no laws in Michigan regarding physician-assisted suicide. The state would go on then and revoke his medical license, but he continued in defiance of that. And in 1998, he was arrested and subsequently convicted for his role in the voluntary euthanasia of a man who suffered from Lou Gehrig's disease. And now, in these instances, this is, we're familiar, my wife and I, this was going on. We grew up in the area, and, you know, these were individuals who knew they were terminally ill and wanted to die with some dignity. Dr. Jack, or Dr. Death, as some started to call him, was convicted of second-degree murder. He would serve 8 years in prison, and he was paroled in 2007. Later, he died in 2011. This event was one of the first memories I have of the community in which I lived being divided over what is morally or ethically right. Some people who thought it was absolutely the other way. It was an act of mercy, and he shouldn't be put to death. He shouldn't be convicted of this because these were individuals who were suffering and in great pain, and they had I remember one case in particular, where the whole family of the patient said, this is what we want to have happen. And they thought it was merciful that he would do this. Most people, however, were somewhere in between, very conflicted, very confused, and just didn't really know how to, you know, what side to come down on the whole matter. If a patient's diagnosed as terminally ill, they're in unbearable pain, and the doctors tell them there is absolutely nothing we can do. You're going to die. If the patient chooses to commit suicide, is that wrong? So if a doctor was to decide to prescribe a lethal drug, as Dr. Jack Kevorkian would do, and it ends the patient's suffering, is that morally or ethically wrong? What if he finds it unethical or immoral to do that? But instead, knowing that he couldn't bring himself to do that, he refers the patient to another doctor who he kind of knows is going to prescribe those medications, and the end result is going to be the same. Is the first doctor still somehow morally or ethically complicit in what occurred? The word for complicit in the dictionary means helping to commit a crime or do wrong in some way. The root of that comes from a Latin word meaning to fold together. So would the doctor in the first instance be complicit? You know, he couldn't do it. He found it immoral, unethical, couldn't do it, but he referred the patient to a doctor who, in the back of his mind, knew would make a decision, prescribe medication that would have the same result. Maybe he's not complicit, but is he culpable? Culpable, that's another word. It means meriting condemnation or blame, especially as wrong or harmful. It can mean deserving reproach or punishment. So maybe the doctor's not complicit in what happened, but would he be culpable, deserving of reproach? Right? The word for complicit implies responsibility or involvement in a crime, a sin, or a grave error, or a misdoing. Whereas being culpable is weaker than complicit. It could sometimes be errors of ignorance or something of omission. You didn't do something you should have done, or even neglect. The second time in my life I recall being faced with a challenging situation of what is the right thing to do was during my days as an engineer, and we were renovating a hospital in Southeast Michigan. And in the course of that project, we were asked to sign non-disclosure agreements. And I said, well, why do we have to, like, what is it? Well, you're going to go in this area, and you can't say what's in there, so you have to sign a non-disclosure. I'm like, well, what's in there? Well, we can't tell you until you sign the non-disclosure. So we signed the non-disclosure, and you go in there, and what it was an animal testing lab. They did live tests. They did testing on live animals in this portion of the hospital, and they did not want the public to know. And so we had to go in there as part of our engineering task to go into this space. And so that was the second time in my life I was faced with something, and this was more directly me, of what's my responsibility here? Am I somehow complicit or culpable or responsible if I carry out my duties as an engineer and work at renovating this lab where they test animals and I can't tell the public about it? The issues we face in our world today are filled with complexities. Complexities that often make it very difficult to formulate clear and proper responses on some issues. Even more so within the church, we have a tendency to think God must have an absolute answer, and if I get it wrong, my eternal life is at stake. So we add that to our processing of things. Yet in doing that, we all do this, myself included, tend to interweave our own personal biases, our political leanings, our medical opinions, our responses to peer pressure and social conditioning, even our level of biblical understanding. We interweave all of that into our ability to rationally process information and reach a conclusion. And as I said, sometimes the things facing us are really complex, really complex. And as I said, furthermore, in the church, we get used to defining things as being right or wrong, righteous or unrighteous. It's sin or it's not sin. It's hard for us to find a space in between those, that spectrum, right? It's either pleasing to God or it's an abomination to God. It can't be both. We don't do good with gray areas. It's just, we don't. We struggle. We try to find answers. We try to find a way to understand it. And in the church, we really have a hard time when two people in the same congregation come to two different conclusions on the same matter, right? Because in the back of our minds, what we struggle with is we both can't be right, and I know I am, right? Is that not what we do, right? Because if I was wrong, I would change, but I know I'm not wrong, so it must be you, right? We never say that, but that is what goes on inside of us, right? This is what we struggle with. And so we often tend to focus too much on what, you know, the other person is doing or not doing, rather than just doing what we believe we must do. I think the message we heard in the sermon, that's going to tie in well with what I have to say. We have an example of Peter struggling with this. Notice John 21. You know, worrying about what other people are doing and the decisions they're making, instead of just doing what I'm supposed to do or what I believe is the right thing to do. Peter had a similar struggle. He posed the question to Jesus Christ about John right after he told Peter to go feed my sheep. John 21, verse 21 and verse 22. So Peter, seeing him, meaning John, said to Jesus, "But Lord, what about John? You're sending me out. What about John here?" And notice Jesus' response in verse 22. He said to him, "If I will that John remains till I come, business is out of yours. You just do what I asked you to do. Don't worry about John." We all struggle with this at times in different ways. You know, we're asked to do something, and we think it's the right thing to do, and we've probably proven it is the right thing to do. And then we see somebody else doing something different, and we go, wait, we both can't be right. Well, Jesus says, you just do what I've asked you to do. And if you believe that's what I've asked you to do, you do that. And don't worry about your brother. What happens, though, sometimes out of our love for a brother, we feel compelled to go inform them or educate them or correct them or choose the word you want because, I mean, after all, we've proven that we're right and we want them to have eternal life as well, so we feel compelled to go tell them, like, I'm doing this because I love you. Yeah, you're wrong. And so, and it can be genuinely sincere because we believe we're right in the matter. And yet we might find that our brother doesn't see things the way that you do. And in that, we have the groundwork for all kinds of tension, turmoil, strife, judging, and in a worst-case scenario, even division. I'm going to cover some topics today that are going to make you uncomfortable, but I hope if you stay with me, we're all going to grow through this experience. And we'll be better at handling some of these complex issues that we often face in life. I'd like to look at the issue of moral culpability. And more importantly, how should we handle disagreements between ourselves over some of these complicated social issues that we will face? I've titled the sermon, Moral Culpability and Christian Responsibility. There's one other item I want to add to this before we go into the topic any deeper is the concept of sin of omission. Omission was one of those terms used in culpability. We all understand what it means to be guilty of a sin we commit, right? You commit adultery, guilty. Fornication, guilty. I mean, you've done it, you're guilty of that. Sins of omission, are those things where we should have done something that God expected of us, but we didn't do it. Maybe not praying as we should could be a sin of omission in God's eyes. Right? You might look at it that way. Again, not praying, not keeping the Sabbath day holy. We might say we keep the Sabbath day, but are we keeping the whole day holy? Sunset to sunset, where is our focus? If we don't fast on the Day of Atonement, the Bible says you'll be cut off. There's a sin of omission. You're guilty of something you were supposed to do but didn't do it. The Bible doesn't use the term itself of sin of omission. Join me in Luke 10. We get this term by looking at a few key scriptures because this is an added component that we put upon ourselves in the church. Are there things I should be doing that I'm not doing that God would look at me as being guilty of? We see an example in Luke 10. It's the account of the Good Samaritan. This was a parable given in response to the question, what shall I do to inherit eternal life? Luke chapter 10, verse 25. A certain lawyer stood up, testing him, saying, Teacher, what shall I do to inherit eternal life? And he said, what's written in the law? What is your reading of it? He said, you shall love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, with all your strength, with all your mind, and your neighbor as yourself. And he said to him, verse 28, you have answered rightly, do this, and you will live. And as is human nature, who's my brother? Like, I get it, but let's be clear here, who's my brother? It's human nature to try to get out of something that we're asked to do. But as we go through the story, we're not going to go through it all. We're familiar with the account. We have two different men, first a priest and then a Levite, who come upon an injured man who's on the side of the road. He's stripped, he's naked, he's left for dead, and both men pass on the other side of the road, not willing to help. And it's the third one, the Samaritan, who in the parable is called the Good Samaritan, he's the one who stopped and helped him. Takes him to an innkeeper, pays for his care. He says, I'll leave you with this. If there's more when I return, I'll reimburse you for that. And notice what Jesus goes on to say then in verse 36. So which one of these three do you think was neighbor to him who fell among the thieves? And he said, he who showed mercy on him. And Jesus said to him, go and do likewise. So the first two men could be considered guilty of committing a sin of omission, not doing what they should have done. The Bible doesn't say that specifically, but you could draw that conclusion. There was something that was asked of them, and they didn't do it. In Matthew 25, we have another example. when Jesus says he will return to judge nations, putting some on his right hand, some on his left. Matthew 25, verse 44. Matthew 25, verse 44. Matthew chapter 25, verse 44. Then they also will answer him, saying, Lord, when did we see you hungry or thirsty or a stranger or naked or sick or in prison and did not minister to you? And then he will say to them, assuredly I say to you, inasmuch as you did not do it to one of the least of these, you did not do it to me. A sin of omission, not doing what God expects us to do. And so in our journey, we have that added responsibility of always asking ourselves, is there something I should be doing that I'm not doing that God may hold account against me? And so that's something that we also have to process. But here Jesus clearly indicates this lack of action could be considered sinful. Lastly, in James 4:17, we have a direct statement that tends to speak to this concept of being guilty of a sin of omission, not doing something that we are expected to do. James chapter 4, verse 17. James 4, verse 17 says, therefore to him who knows to do good and does not do it, to him it is sin. And so if you know there's something that you should be doing and you know you're not doing it, the Bible clearly says to that person it is sin. This one verse alone provides kind of an overarching basis for this concept of sin of omission. But it's important that we note that the instruction is to do. If you know what to do, do it. For you not to do it, it's sin. It doesn't say that if you know to do good, you need to get everybody together and start telling everybody what you've learned to do good, and they're not doing it. It just says, if you know that, you do it. It just says to go and do it. So again, as I said in the beginning, as we dig into this, always remember that we have a tendency to think that there has to be an absolute answer to everything. Look, I got an engineering background. I loved math in school. I loved getting to absolute finite conclusions to two-hour-long math problems. I'm one of those that's used to there being an absolute answer to everything. It's taken me most of my life to realize that a lot of things don't have those kind of answers. It can be a struggle. We don't do good with gray areas. And as I said a moment ago, we struggle when two of us in the same congregation come to different conclusions on the same matter, because we both can't be right. Somewhere in our mind, we think this one of us has to be wrong. And as I said, we know it's not us, right? It has to be the other person. So let me correct you. It's kind of what happens subconsciously in our, you know, in our dealings with one another. Hold your place here in James 4. I'm going to go over to Psalms 19. We're going to come back to James 4 in a moment. Notice the words of the psalmist David wrote in Psalm 19. In the beginning of the chapter, verses 7 through 9, let me get over there. He gives some descriptors. The law of the Lord is perfect. The testimony of the Lord is right. The commandments of the Lord is pure. Fear of the Lord is clean. He makes all these statements. Judgments of the Lord are true and they're righteous altogether. But notice Psalm 19. Notice verse 12. Who can understand his errors? Cleanse me from secret faults. Verse 13. Keep back your servant also from presumptuous sins. Let them not have dominion over me. Then I shall be blameless, and I shall be innocent of great transgression. The word for presumptuous, the Hebrew, I'll give you the number, you can look it up, 2086 Z. And it's an adjective meaning proud or arrogant. A literal translation of verse 13 could be, keep me from arrogance. So think about that in our dealings with one another. I've come to conclude something is right, and I think maybe you have a different view that's probably not correct. David says, don't let me become arrogant. Like, because maybe I am wrong, first of all, but the key is don't let me become arrogant over whatever it is we may have come to understand. I think if we could all remember that, as we heard in the first message, and learn to be patient with one another, and just be careful that we don't, you know, cause, you know, disharmony or disunity simply because we disagree. David's plea was, keep me from arrogance, presumptuous sin. Let's go back to James chapter 4, because in the beginning of the chapter, before reading what we did in verse 17 about knowing to do good and not doing it, he begins in verse 1 by speaking of, where do wars and fights come from among you? Do they not come from your desires for pleasure that war in your members? Verse 6, but he says he gives more grace. Therefore, he says, God resists the proud. Keep me from presumptuousness. Keep me from arrogance. God resists the proud, but he gives grace to the humble. Therefore, verse 7, submit to God, resist the devil, and he will flee from you. Verse 10, humble yourselves in the sight of the Lord, and he will lift you up. Do not speak evil of one another, brethren. He who speaks evil of a brother and judges his brother speaks evil of the law and judges the law. Notice what he says next. But if you judge the law, you're no longer a doer. Now you're a judge. And what did he read, right? Go and do. Be a doer. He says, if you start judging one another, you're no longer a doer. Now you're a judge. And yet what he says he's going to hold us to is to do good. One who knows to do good but does not do it, to him it is sin. So how you and I handle differing conclusions in some manners, as James said, can lead to wars amongst us, right? As I said in the beginning, in the extreme, it could lead to division, which I think we're all tired of, right? I think, can we all agree that we're tired of that? But he says, look, if we don't handle things correctly, that's the ultimate end of it all. And that's the warning, is we got to get ahead of this. Because, you know, last 2 years were tough, but, you know, buckle up. Something else will come. It will. I don't know what it is. I'm not a prophet. But something will. And I think, as I said, this is just kind of helped to train us a little bit. We need to be ready for these things. So, again, how we handle things could lead to wars. But there's an opposite outcome as well. If you go back to John 13, because, again, how we handle it could lead to war, disputes, divisions, you know, unrest. But there's something else that we should never forget in John 13, in verse 34, where it says, a new commandment I give to you, that you love one another as I have loved you, that you also love one another. And by this, all will know that you are my disciples, if you have love for one another. And as we heard in the first message, love includes patience and forbearance and giving the benefit of the doubt and all those things that go into it. If we can do that, then the world will know you're my disciples. Does it say that because you're going to agree on everything? It doesn't say that. He says you are loving towards one another. You're patient. Right? So if we can be those living examples of what true disciples are, then we don't have to worry about wars and divisions and strife and unrest. Right? We learn to be patient with one another and giving space for each other and the decisions that they make. You know, there's no step-by-step instructions on how to deal with some of the complex issues. I'm going to touch on a couple here in a moment. We don't have anything. We're going to look at some biblical examples that we could apply. You may have others that we could talk about afterwards. You know, if somebody says, puts item A in front of you, you can't go to the Bible and look up item A because it's not in there. But you have to look up different instructions to see how we can apply them. But we always must ask ourselves, what is my responsibility before God for how my actions impact, number one, salvation for me, but his church? How do my actions impact the church? Does it help or does it hinder? Does it help to unify or does it just add to, you know, causing division? So we have these three concepts. We have, am I complicit? Would God consider me culpable? Or have I committed some sin of omission? I should have done something and I didn't do it. So I'm going to give you some examples. Some of these are going to be simple, right? But what I really hope to achieve in doing this is that we can walk away and at least agree that some things are just not black and white. They're just not. And more importantly, that we get better at being patient with each other. Because in the end, you answer to God for your decisions, and I will answer to God for my decisions. When you stand before God for whatever decisions you made in your life, you can't say, well, my pastor told me. Now, if I did and I'm wrong, then I got guilt on me, right? You have to prove all things to yourself. You have to make decisions and know that you will stand before God and make the decision, you know, an answer for the decisions you make. If you conclude a certain action is good, as James 4:17 says, you should do it. And if you don't, to you it is sin. And the other thing we want to walk away is realizing that if we begin judging the actions of a brother, that is sin. Because you stop being a doer and you become a judge, as we just read in James 4. Right? So we want to be doers, not judges of one another. Okay, I got an easy question to begin with. Your neighbor cheats on his taxes. It's tax season. You find out your neighbor cheats on his taxes, and you don't report him, and you know he did. Are you complicit? Did you help commit a crime or do wrong in some way? No. Are you culpable? Do you merit condemnation or blame or deserve reproach or punishment? Right? Are you culpable? Maybe I won't answer that. Let's just think about that one. I would say no. Have you committed a sin of omission? You know to do good and didn't do it. Well, you know, there's no law that says that you have to report on your neighbor cheating on his taxes. There's no law that says that. In fact, as I was working on the sermon a month ago, I was thinking, you know, some people probably would even go to Romans 12. You know, if at all possible, I'll live peaceably at all men. So, no, I'm not turning my neighbor in. I want to be at peace with my neighbor. I'm not going to be the one that's going to, you know, snitch on him. So that one's pretty easy. How about you lend your garden hose to your neighbor? And these are going to get harder. You know this, right? They're going to get harder. This is another easy one. You lend your garden hose to your neighbor, and later you find out he's using it to water his marijuana plants that he's growing in the backyard, and you didn't know that. Right? So let's go down our list again. Are you complicit? Now, I don't know, maybe there's a law out there that would somehow try to make you complicit in a crime. I don't know. I don't think there is. Did you help to commit a crime? I don't think you did. Would you be culpable? Do you merit blame? Do you deserve punishment? I mean, you gave him the water hose. If you didn't have a water hose, they would have, you know, drought would have killed them. Or did you commit a sin of omission? You know to do something that's good, you didn't do it. Well, if we take that example and we hold rigidly firm to an idea that any indirect association with that guy growing his marijuana plants, anything to help him water his marijuana plants, makes us morally complicit or morally culpable, then we have to look at Matthew 5 and ponder, what does that make God culpable or complicit? Because in Matthew 5, again, this is just, does this apply to what we're looking at? Matthew 5, verse 43, it says, you've heard that it was said, you shall love your neighbor and hate your enemy. But I say to you, love your enemies, bless those who curse you, do good to those who hate you, and pray for those who spitefully use you and persecute you, that you may be sons of your Father in heaven. For he makes his sun rise on the evil, growing marijuana, right? And on the good. He sends rain on your neighbor, growing marijuana, right? And on the just, you know, and the just and the unjust. Now, it might be different if the next time he comes over, he asks for the garden hose. That's probably going to be a little bit of a different personal challenge. The first time, he didn't know. Second time, he might go, oh, I know why he's doing this. Here, you can have my hose. Don't come ask me anymore. I don't know. But God reigns, puts the sun upon the just and the unjust. Right? So, again, you'll have to draw your own conclusion on that. You know, if I knew that my neighbor was doing something that was probably illegal, I would just say no. But in the first instance, if I didn't know, I found out later, I wouldn't be responsible. I didn't know. Remember, it goes back and it says, to him who knows to do good. So you have to know in that instance that you were lending your hose knowing what he was going to do with it. Here's another one. How about your company's 401k program? So you're involved in your company's retirement plan, you put money in your 401k, and all of the mutual funds invest 99% of their money in lofty, altruistic, socially responsible, you know, bunnies and unicorns and rainbows, wonderful things, right? But there's that 1%, that 1% that they're investing in, maybe it's gambling or cannabis, right? Because that's a popular thing now, that, or, you know, tobacco or things like that. What do you do? You know, are you complicit? Are you helping to commit a crime because your money in a retirement plan, they're out there buying shares of stock in companies that do things that we don't think God would be pleased with? Are you culpable? Do you merit some condemnation or blame? Have you committed a sin of omission? How far does God expect us to go in sorting out the tangled web of everything going on in our world today? Do you move all your funds into a money market account? And just put it in cash and let it sit there, because that's the only way I can be absolutely sure. Well, I would say if that's the decision you reach, you should do that, if that's how you feel. But as I said, you know, when we begin, it's when we begin to start questioning what each other is doing and start casting judgment in on one another, because we've concluded this is okay and this is not okay, that we start having problems here, you know, as a church. You know, for those that aren't familiar, I spent some years in that industry. Fund managers buy and sell underlying positions so frequently that you can't keep track of it, right? You could conclude today that they have, you know, they own 1% of their stocks in something, and they move out of it, and everything's fine, and tomorrow they could be back in it again. You just don't know. That's how often they will be buying in and out of various companies. But again, one person might conclude that to move all their money into a money market fund because they think it would be the right thing to do. Another person might conclude, since there's no way of really knowing, I'm not complicit or culpable or responsible. Different people are going to reach different conclusions. And we need to just remember, each one of us answers for our own decisions, not for what my neighbor's doing, not for what my other member of the congregation's doing. So you can see how this gets a little bit more difficult. Now, there's always somebody going, oh, this isn't that difficult. I got this figured out. But it does. It gets a little more difficult. You know, something that just reminds you of a time when some years ago, my wife and I realized that Doritos used pork enzymes, in their ingredients. And we're like, okay, we're going to quit using Doritos, right, because it's got pork in it. And so that was the decision we made. And, you know, there's a part of you, after a while, you're going, oh, look at this. They brought Doritos to the church potluck. Are you kidding me? There's probably Doritos back there right now, by the way. And you start going, should we say something? Maybe they don't know. Maybe we should tell them. And then we had friends like, I don't want to hear it. Because if I know to do good, I have to do it. But we just kind of went on our way and didn't really, it was just whatever. It just wasn't our place to make a big issue out of it. And then some years later, somehow it came up. And somebody at church goes, oh, no. They changed that like 5 years ago. We're like, oh, man, we missed out on Doritos for 5 years. And so you go to Frito-Lay's website, and they list their all ingredients, right? But ingredients in food changes all the time. So you could be right today and wrong tomorrow and then back right again. So the point of that is you just got to do the best you can, right? But that was an example where, you know, again, it's like, well, we're going to stop buying Doritos. We'll buy the crummy no-name brands that don't even come close to taste. But my point of saying that is if you're not careful, you become the self-righteous judge. You're no longer a doer. You're judging everybody else because they're bringing Doritos to church. Can you believe them? If you're not careful, it can go that far. And we never want it to go that far. So you can see how sometimes these things can be difficult. But again, when it comes to your 401k, you know, are you complicit or culpable, right? Because the fund manager is putting money in this fund and then he's moving it. Let's talk now about a matter that has polarized our society and to some extent has even caused tensions in the church. Vaccines. I want to share some facts with you because some have said that the current COVID vaccines contain, critical word, contain aborted fetal tissue. From all the research I have done, and assuming the data is that's provided is honest, and I will take them at face value, I'll take them at their word, what I have come to determine from what I've read is that statement's not 100% correct. All vaccines are tested on fetal cell lines. There's a distinction. They're tested on them. I'll share a little bit more about the science behind it. But first of all, you know, vaccines are just chemicals stirred in a vat. We want to be blunt, right? Put it in simple terms. And then they're tested on things. And they're often, and they have been for many, many years, going back to the 1930s, this isn't a new thing, been tested on fetal cell lines. The two mRNA vaccines, Pfizer and Moderna, do not contain fetal cells. Some of the testing on the vaccine was done on them, but they don't contain them. They were tested on an HEK293 embryonic line out of kidney cells. The source of it was an aborted fetus that happened in 1972. Right? The viral vector vaccine, the J&J one, does contain fetal cells. They use a PER.C6 from a fetus that was aborted in 1985. It was stored in liquid nitrogen, it was frozen, and 10 years later they took it out and they started using it. Now you gotta keep in mind, a fetal cell line, you can't just like add more aborted tissue to it because now it's a new line. So these two lines, one of them's from 1972, the other one's from 1985. They're old, they keep them around, they use them for testing. Both of them were made in labs for different reasons. The HEK293 was for just general research. The PERC6 was for pharmaceutical manufacturing. So, but before moving on specifically about this, you would be shocked at how many commonly used products probably in your home and probably in mine have been tested on fetal cell lines. I'm not going to give you a list. If it concerns you, you can do your own research. It's out there. You can find it as easily as I did. It includes food, cosmetics, over-the-counter medicines, because again, the testing on fetal cell lines goes back to the 30s. So this is not a new thing. That's what I want to emphasize. This is nothing new. I believe the fetal cell argument suddenly became an issue when the real issue that's upsetting people in our society is being told you have to do something. That is the real, if you can set that emotion out of a discussion, you can have a much better discussion. Because the truth of it is, a lot of people just don't like the government telling them you're forced to do something. And so in doing that, they wanted to list out all their reasons why they don't want to be forced to do something. And this was one that was brought into that argument. Fair enough, but it's not new. You can do the research. Most childhood vaccines were developed in the very same way. This isn't new. So I just want to give that background because, again, I think being forced was the new development. The way they were developed was not new. I mean, there's some new technology in the RNA vaccines, but the issue of fetal cell lines has been around for a long time. And again, as I said, some foods, and like I said, you can find it. I'm not going to name companies. There's a company out there that does a lot of food taste development on fetal cell lines. I know the name of the company. I'm just not going to say it. And a lot of companies contract with them to test products. Right? So often in something that you would have ingredients on, and if it's minute enough, it might just say natural flavorings. It could, doesn't always, it could come from that. You just have no way of knowing. But that's always a possibility. So again, my point of saying all this is, you see how complicated this is? It's just not as easy as some people want to think it is. So the question arises then, if I take advantage of a vaccine, or eat a particular food, or wear a particular cosmetic, or take an over-the-counter medication, am I complicit in abortion? Because some people struggle with that. Am I complicit? Am I morally culpable? Remember those terms we went through, complicit, culpable, right? Sin of omission. Am I somehow morally culpable? Again, the research I've done on both of these cell lines, again, one started in 1972, the other in 1985. There's been no additional contributions to the cell line because it would come up. The cell lines are named after whoever develops it. HEK is a guy's initials. 293 was the 293rd iteration before he isolated it and it could be used. That's how it gets its numbering. So if it was something, another abortion occurred, then there'd be a new number. So, you know, the fact that if somebody says, well, if I take a vaccine, that causes an abortion, that's not the case, right? Just to be clear on that. This is a strain that's been around for a long time. The question, though, is will God hold you accountable for the sin of abortion in 1972 or 1985? Are you complicit? Are you culpable? Let's go to Deuteronomy 24. Let's see if we can get a better understanding of this. And again, I'm not here to tell you what to do in your life or not. I just want us to look at what we can glean out of the scripture and apply in our lives as we do the best we can in a really complicated world that we live in, right? Deuteronomy 24. Because as I said earlier, and I'll probably say a couple more times before I'm done, at the end of the day, you have to make your decision, right? And just know that and make it as informed as you can, and know that God will hold you accountable for your decisions, not somebody else's decisions, and then just move on with your life. Just you do the best you can. Deuteronomy 24, verse 16. Fathers shall not be put to death for their children, nor shall children be put to death for their fathers. A person shall be put to death for his own sin. Not a sin that occurred in 1972 or 1985, but again, if that's a conscience issue for you, then you act according to your conscience. I'm not trying to encourage that, I'm just simply saying that is a sin that happened in 1972. That sin is done and passed. So again, let's also look at Exodus 32. Exodus chapter 32, we're familiar with this. Moses saw the golden calf the Israelites had made. He returns back up the mountain, and notice his exchange with God in Exodus 32, beginning in verse 31. Then Moses returned to the Lord and said, "Oh, these people have committed a great sin and have made for themselves a god of gold. Yet now, if you will forgive their sin, but if not, I pray, blot me out of your book which you have written. Kill me because they sinned. Blot me out of your book because they sinned." And the Lord said to Moses, verse 33, "Whoever has sinned against me, I will blot him out of my book. Each person will answer for their own sin." Right? Again, verse 33, "Whoever has sinned against me, I will blot him out of my book." Let's notice also Ezekiel 18, another example here, Ezekiel 18. Ezekiel 18, the chapter begins talking about a man who walks uprightly with God, and it is concluded in Ezekiel 18 in verse 19 about this man who walked uprightly. Ezekiel 18 and verse 9. "If he has walked in my statutes and kept my judgments faithfully, he is just. He shall surely live, says the Lord God." So this is the end of a man who walked uprightly before God. And then the chapter goes on in verses 10 through 13 to speak of that man's son who does not walk uprightly. And it is concluded in verse 13, "If he has exacted usury or taken increase, shall he then live? He shall not live. If he has done any of these abominations, he shall surely die. His blood shall be on him. His father was righteous, that man lives. This man was unrighteous, he's not going to live." And then he goes on again, continues in verse 14 to 17 to speak of the next generation, the son of the unrighteous man, who then walked uprightly as his grandfather did. And the conclusion in verse 17 is, "Who has withdrawn his hand from the poor and not received usury or increase, but has executed my judgments and walked in my statutes, he shall not die for the iniquity of his father. he shall surely live. Verse 20, the end of all this is spelled out in verse 20, Ezekiel 18. The soul who sins shall die. The son shall not bear the guilt of the father, nor the father bear the guilt of the son. The righteousness of the righteous shall be upon himself, and the wickedness of the wicked shall be upon himself. We all answer for our own sins, is the end of the matter. So again, I'm not here to tell you what you should or should not do as it relates to your health or medical treatment, anything. I mean, there's a whole list of things that we don't even have time to explore. We could get into blood transfusions and organ transplants, and there's so many other aspects that we could examine. What I'm trying to get us all to see and appreciate is these things are just not as black and white as we all wish they would be black and white. We all wish it would be simple, but it's not simple. And so we all struggle. And the key is that we have to be patient with one another and not judge one another in all of these matters. Now, I spent a lot of time on this vaccine and the abortion because I know that's a big issue. So I want to just pause now. Let's just forget the vaccine. Let's just take the topic of abortion all by itself. Right? So not necessarily the vaccine, but let's just look at that topic. Who is complicit? Who is morally culpable in an abortion, right? A doctor performing the abortion, we would all say, well, he's committing murder. I don't think we would debate that. Does it matter if the child was conceived via rape or incest or any other way? It's either a life or it's not a life. What about nurses and doctors nurses and others that are involved in the procedure? Would they be complicit? Would they be culpable? What about the administrative staff? What about the receptionist that works at the place, right? Doesn't necessarily have to be Planned Parenthood. It could be a doctor's office. And she's a receptionist at a doctor's office. What about the woman who made the choice to have the abortion? Or what about the person who drove the woman to the clinic? What about the person who donates or does fundraising for organizations that fund abortions? Let's say for a moment we all agreed that they're all guilty, every one of them. The receptionist, yep, because she knows what's going on back there. She's complicit. She's at least morally culpable. Maybe we come to that conclusion. Well, then, you know, and the people that donate, oh, yeah, they're definitely guilty. You know, they're helping to fund the whole thing. Well, then we got to ask the question, what is our involvement? Are we morally culpable of abortion, donating to it, because we shop or purchase products like, and I'm going to give you a list. There's dozens. Who's ever bought something from Amazon? They donate to the industry. Are you culpable? Because, you know, you used Amazon, AT&T, you know, Clorox, you know, Burt's Bees. Everybody likes Burt's Bees because it's natural. GoFundMe, Home Depot. I'm dead on that one because I buy a lot of stuff from Home Depot. You drive a Honda? Are you morally culpable because you drive a Honda and Honda donates to industries that promote abortion? Microsoft, Olive Garden, Office Depot, Nike, Rotary Club, Starbucks, United Way, Verizon, YMCA, YWCA. So if we were going to jump to the conclusion that all those other people are somehow morally culpable, are we now morally culpable because of the products we buy and those companies donating to those industries? Now, again, if that troubles you and you choose to move away from them, you certainly can do that. You know, one, it's been popular on the radio. Because, again, you can even ask yourself, should you work for one of those companies? Maybe you have to quit your job because the company I work for does these things. But, you know, there's an ad on the radio for a particular cell phone company that's promoting, oh, if you come to us, you know, because they really bash Verizon for donating to these things. And so they say, oh, join us because we don't give money to those things. But we use the same cell networks as Verizon. So you know what that means. They have a contract with Verizon to use Verizon's towers. So the company itself may not directly, but the minute they pay Verizon to use the towers, indirectly, they're contributing. And so that's the question we have to ask ourselves is, am I now somehow indirectly, you know, how far removed does it have to be where God says you're not culpable? We just read that the Father answers for his sins, the Son answers for his own. But as I say all that, if you really feel you have to make those changes, you should do that. You should. But don't judge a brother if they don't see it quite the same way. What about paying your utility bills? Are you responsible if your utility company donates to Planned Parenthood? Or they sponsor a LGBTQ parade in your town? Do you stop paying your utility bill? Do you don't pay your taxes because the city, you know, does these things? Right? Should you continue? Are you complicit or culpable or committing sins of some type if you let your tax dollars go to things that you don't think are right? Stop paying your taxes. As I said when I gave the sermon before, I'll come visit you in prison, maybe. But you can. You could say, I'm not doing that. But, you know, the disciples came to Jesus in the same manner and asked him that question. Remember about should we pay taxes to Caesar? And what did he say? Who's on the coin? Caesar. What's the inscription? It's Caesar's. Render to Caesar what's his. Give him his taxes. But then he says, render to me, render to God what is God's, which is the rest of your life. You know, our dollar bills aren't ours. Look at them. They're Federal Reserve notes. So render under the Federal Reserve what belongs to the Federal Reserve. How about things like, are we guilty for child slave labor issues? Multiple news agencies report that child slave labor of types is being used in the mining of cobalt in the Democratic Republic of Congo, the DRC. Guess what cobalt is used in? Batteries. All kinds of batteries. Cobalt and lithium are the two prime ingredients in common devices like cell phones. Am I morally culpable? I've got, you know, hang me right now. I already told you I shop at Home Depot, right? I have a Verizon cell phone service on a Samsung phone that uses batteries that are all... This is how complex our world is today. It's a mess, right? And it's going to get messier. And that's why we all have to be kind of hyper aware of how, if we're not careful, we can let these things get under our skin and begin to judge one another and cause problems. As I said on the child labor issue, UNICEF estimates 40,000 children work in those mines, right? They're making, you know, a dollar a day or whatever it is. And they're, if you look at pictures of those mines, they're certainly not safe. But those batteries are used in products by Apple and Microsoft and Tesla and Samsung, you know, a lot of the electric vehicles. So, you know, are we supposed to go out there and, you know, publicly shame anybody in a congregation that shows up in an electric vehicle? That's how complex our world is today. Do we feel, you know, should we be more righteous? Should we feel better because we promote green technology over fossil fuels when they both have their own issues? So again, would you or I be complicit or culpable in some manner before God because I have a cell phone? The way I personally see it is I have a contract with Verizon to make my phone work, and I pay them to do what they say they're going to do. What they do with that money, that blood's on them. And if I had other options, maybe I would pursue other options. But again, I think everybody has to come to a certain decision for themselves. But moving from this one to that one, I could almost guarantee you, will be inconsequential. You know, most cellular networks, I used to do engineering on cellular networks back in the beginning when AT&T was building a lot of towers. And you've got a few major companies that actually own the infrastructure. Companies like Verizon and AT&T are the two big ones. And everybody else leases their services. That's just the way it is. Because you can't have, you know, 700 cell phone companies all putting up towers. So the federal government has said, you get to own towers, you get to own towers. Everybody else has to buy service off those towers. One other example we can look at is in Romans 14. It's probably the only other example. There's probably others we could talk about. But notice Romans 14. Paul is addressing the reality or the fact that there had been disputes in the church over doubtful things is the term that he uses. The term doubtful things has to do with things that men would ponder or reason or wonder about. And Paul is going to impress upon the church to not judge each other over the choices one makes. Again, each one of us will give an account for the choice we make based on doing our own research and coming to a conclusion. Sometimes you'll reach a conclusion that's here, and you may get 5 years down the road and reach a different conclusion. You have better understanding, new information, whatever it may be. So we always have to be willing to be flexible because things will change. But Paul's pressing upon them not to judge one another. Romans 14, verse 1, receive one who is weak in the faith, but not to disputes over doubtful things. For one believes he may eat all things, but he who is weak eats only vegetables. Let not him who eats despise him who does not eat. Let not him who does not eat judge him who eats, for God has received him. Because again, he points out again, now you're judging somebody. Who are you to judge another servant? To his own master he stands or falls. Indeed, he will be made to stand, for God is able to make him stand. Drop down to verse 10 to get to the heart of the matter. But why do you judge your brother, or why do you show contempt for your brother? For we shall all stand before the judgment seat of Christ. Verse 11, for it is written, as I live, says the Lord, every knee shall bow to me, and every tongue shall confess to God. So then each of us shall give an account of himself to God. I don't give an account for you, and you don't give an account for me. You give an account for yourself. And so it's important for you to do your research and know why you're making any decisions in your life, whatever they are. And you can come and get counsel. You can have friends that you may want to bounce ideas off of. But at the end of the day, you have to own that decision. Again, let us not judge one another anymore, but rather resolve this not to put a stumbling block or a cause to fall in our brother's way. I believe this speaks to what Paul wrote about not becoming arrogant. You've reached a decision. To him who knows to do good, do it. You should do what you believe is the right decision to do, knowing that you will answer to God for your decision, and then just don't worry about your brother. Right? Sometimes that's a difficult thing for us to do. Each one gives an account for his own decision. Verse 19, Romans 14. Therefore, let us pursue the things which make for peace and the things by which one may edify another. Right? Pursue those things rather than things that could just rub us wrong and cause strife. And notice then in verse 22 what he says. Do you have faith? Have it to yourself before God. Happy is he who does not condemn himself in what he approves, but he who doubts is condemned if he eats, because he does not eat from faith, for whatever is not from faith is sin. Keep it to yourself. You know, our example of our little Dorito thing, it wasn't a big deal. It seemed important back then, right? But, you know, it's not something we went around making a big deal. You know, sometimes people would ask us and we would tell them, but maybe we didn't have to tell them. Maybe we would have been fine to just say nothing as well. So, you know, what can we do then as we wrap this up? We shouldn't be going around trying to convince anybody of our viewpoint on something. You know, they may ask you, and then you have to make a decision, right? Should I? Is it going to help? Is it going to cause more strife? You know, this last year has been interesting. You know, it's a, get vaxxed, don't get vaxxed, and people telling each other what to do. Right? Don't even ask people, right? It's a personal decision. Let them decide for themselves. You know, don't walk up to somebody, I see you drove up in that new hybrid car. You know about the whole battery thing Mr. Martin said, and no. Right? We shouldn't do that. Don't come up to me after a church and talk about my cell phone. I've already thrown myself under the bus on that one, okay? So, and we shouldn't be bringing boycott lists to church and putting them out there because we want to help edify everybody, because it just causes unrest. In your private one-on-one conversations with somebody and your close friends, you know, you can have those conversations. You know, again, as we just read here, some things we keep to ourselves, right? And if somebody comes and asks you, like I said, you may even decide, I'm just going to keep something to myself. I don't want to cause unrest. So I hope I've made my point clear. I hope the sermon helps. The key points being that the issues that we face are so complex, it's really difficult to formulate an absolute right or wrong, yes or no, black or white decision on some of these things. We as a church often don't do good with gray areas, right? And in that, we struggle with how can you be right and I'm right? And we just have a hard time with that. And so as a result, we sometimes try to convince one another, and it leads to unrest. We all struggle with some of these issues. Look, I don't like the fact that companies that I do business with donate some of the money, to organizations that I believe God abhors. But I also don't like that they put their name on a stadium either, because that means they're charging me too much money and they got money to burn. So I don't like that either. But, at the end of the day, that's what they do. Apparently marketing people thinks that's a good thing, right? Millions of dollars to name a stadium. But we should all consider whether any actions of our life would result in God seeing us as complicit, right? Helping to commit a crime, culpable, meaning we merit some condemnation or blame or have some responsibility, or that we committed a sin of omission. You knew to do good and you didn't do it. Right? We all have to analyze and evaluate ourselves. So then what's the Christian responsibility? Number one, just do the very best that you can. Right? Research, study, compare it to Scripture. Do the best you can. Number two, we're going to be judged on our own decisions, not the decisions of the person sitting next to you. God will judge you on your decisions. And number three, we must be patient with one another when our choices differ. We got to be patient. And as we read earlier, Jesus said in John 13:35, "And by this all men will know that you are my disciples, if we have love for one another."